ran back and gripped Howard's shoulder again. We all do, Howard. We all love you.
Father Gannon, commanded the Monsignor, Mrs. Arkaday needs you inside.
As if a spell had been broken, the young priest blinked, and his hand fell to his side. He started toward the rectory, then looked back at Howard with a trembling smile.
I'll be right back, he said. Howard's going home now, the Monsignor said. He's done for the day, aren't you, Howard?
That night he threw the leftovers into the garbage. He would cook his own food. The macaroni boiled over, and then the cheese slices burned in the fry pan, but he ate it anyway, feeling stronger with every mushy noodle. After that, he tried to watch television by himself, but it was a scary murder show, so he turned it off and sat staring at the sweet plaster face looking back at him from the coffee table. Poor baby Jesus. Josiah had lost interest in them both. That's when he got the idea of changing the Infant of Prague's clothes. Maybe if he did, God might start paying a little closer attention to how bad things were going in Howard Menke's life. He looked through all the boxes in Josiah's closet, but he couldn't decide which outfit to choose, so he worked up all his courage and went downstairs to the Holy Articles shop to ask if there were any special holy days coming up. Miss Brastus, a shy woman with a faint mustache, whispered through the chain door. She and Howard weren't used to each other. It was Josiah she always dealt with.
It's ordinary time, she said, looking down the hallway.
I mean now, this month, he tried to explain, glancing back to see what she was looking at.
That's what this is. The whole summer, it's ordinary time. There aren't any special feasts then.
Oh, he said,
and with her closing door, everything felt flat and hopeless again. It was ordinary time, and there was nothing to look forward to and no one to love. There wasn't even a special outfit for the infant to wear. Howard's eyes shot open. It was the middle of the night. One by one through the darkness, familiar shapes drifted to the surface. A plaster horse lamp, his Fort Ticonderoga mug, the nude infant of Prague. Waiting for Josiah, he had fallen asleep in the chair. He felt his way to her room, where the white emptiness of her bed was all he could see. He went outside and sat on the narrow porch, which was crowded with Josiah's summering houseplants. He tried to think of happy times, people, and places he liked, but not one good thought came to him. After a few minutes, he got up and walked to the corner, standing close by the street lamp, looking first one way and then the other for his sister. Slowly, he began to walk up the hill. He headed south on Main Street, turning left at the church, past the rectory, past the Fermoils. He kept looking back over both shoulders, sometimes stopping and completely turning. Now that he was on Stratton Road, he could hear dogs barking. Gravel crunched underfoot and roadside weeds snagged his ankles. The distance between houses increased until he was passing long wooded stretches that hummed with the dark rush of water and the steady beat of crickets. And now the ghostly hoot of an owl. A branch snapped. His eyes widened and his mouth puckered with the parchedness of dry cotton. He began to blink as his brain pinged with hundreds, thousands, millions of random words, thoughts, sounds, flashes of memory distant as stars, images of her hair, thin and grayly dry against her face, of her lost slipper found after its mate had finally been thrown out, and how sad that made them both feel, how frustrated, how stupid. Of the quick, scared way she'd call out his name through the dark. Howard, Howard. He rubbed his nose against this stench that signaled the hot, hummusy rot of the dump, and a little farther on the sourness of the pig farm. He passed a high chain-link fence, clotted with brown paper, the mounds beyond glinting with sand and glass shards, and now, ahead on the same side of the road, Grandine Carson's house loomed tall and stark in the bright moonlight. Three trucks were parked in the front yard, the big black garbage truck, a panel truck mounted on cinder blocks, and the green pickup that usually brought Josiah home. Behind the house, Two wide barns were linked by a maze of low, slant-roofed sheds and outbuildings, some so dilapidated their fallen doors lay long composted in the weed-patched earth, and their windows, where there were any, hung by dint of a rusted hinge or stubborn splinter. He hurried on, drawn to one lit window at the rear of the house. He ducked under a tree and stared at the long aperture of bright glass that seemed to grow both in size and brilliance until, like a giant blazing star hurtling straight at him, it was all he could see, indeed was all there was to see. Now, as he crept closer, his eyes glowed with the light that contained Carson with a can of beer in his hand, and across the table, Josiah, her eyes soft with an expression Howard had seen only in movies. He stood there for a long time, watching sadly as they talked. It seemed such a serious and important conversation that he knew it had nothing to do with him. Suddenly a dog barked. Carson cocked his head, listening. Howard ran in a crouch, then flattened himself against a tin-walled shed. A door creaked open.
"Better get the hell out of here," Carson warned.
For a moment there was no sound.
"Probably them raccoons again,"
Josiah said, with such familiarity that a piece of his heart hissed out like a quick, weak match. When the door creaked to a close, he darted past the first barn. He ran, jumped, hopped, slashed through muck, stumbled, then with skidding feet reeled headlong through a wooded darkness and down an embankment, and by then he knew he was completely out of control, helpless and unstoppable. He was panting and sweating and crying to himself when finally he fell and just lay there on his side, caught by brambles, but grateful that the earth held him and would not give him up. At first he thought he was in a cave, but then he saw stars glimmering through the tangled branches overhead. After the few seconds it took for him to adjust to this deeper-bellied night, he continued to peer at the moonlit eyes staring up from the dark clover. And then he knew by its foulness and the slick darkness of its bloated gleam that he had done a terrible thing, that he had come too far to ever find his way back to the way things used to be. And worse, there was no one he could tell. Another week had passed, a week of such intense heat that the tar on busy roads softened to ruts, and people stayed in their houses all day, their shades pulled and curtains drawn. Business was slow downtown, but the lakes and the town pool were always crowded, and every night cars waited in line to get into the A plus X. In the 2 weeks since Marie had signed the money from her bank loan over to Omar, she had heard from him twice. His most recent call had come last week to tell her he was still in Connecticut in Presto Soap's training program. They had him out in the field, covering small towns in the western part of the state. He had sounded tired and flat.
"I'm a little too old for all this driving around,"
he had sighed into the phone.
"Tell you the truth, this is work for a younger man."
"Driving?" she'd asked. "Whose car are you using?"
"Damn, that was supposed to be my big surprise, but I can't keep anything from you, can I?"
He had paused.
"Marie, I went and bought a new car."
"New?" she had said, almost choking. "How could you afford a new car?"
"Well, it's a used car, but new for me. It's a 56 Caddy,"
he had whispered.
"White. Not one bit of rust. I can't wait for you to see it. I can't wait for you to be in it with me."
"Omar," she had interrupted, softly so the children wouldn't hear. "When's the soap coming?"
"Let's see."
Papers rustled.
"Here we go. From the looks of these back orders, well, a couple weeks anyway."
"A couple weeks? I can't wait a couple weeks. Omar, the first payment on the loan's due in 2 weeks."
"And that's right about when the soap will get there, so don't worry. Relax, Marie, just..."
"Omar, I need time to sell the soap to get the money for the loan. I mean, I can't just get the soap. I mean, the bank won't..." "Oh, God, Omar, do you see what I'm saying?" He had assured her there was nothing to worry about. If worse came to worst, he'd make the first payment himself. Soon she'd have her soap, and in no time at all, the money would be pouring in. He said he'd be back in Atkinson just as soon as his training ended.
But then he'd hung up without telling her when that would be or where he was staying in Connecticut. The next day on her lunch break, she had seen a white Cadillac coming along Merchant's Row. Certain it was Omar, she had left work early, expecting to find him waiting for her at the house. That had been 5 days ago. She looked up now as Mr. Briscoe rushed through the door with an invoice. He was angry because he had waited all last winter for Kruter skis, and now all they had sent him were children's lengths. A note on the invoice said the adult skis would come later.
"Call Kruter," he fumed,
flipping through her Rolodex for the number,
"because they're getting the whole mess back. They must think I'm some kind of fool, some jerk they can keep putting off. Well, I'm not that desperate that I'm taking this crap. No, sir, no way, and you can tell them that," he said, stabbing his finger at the card. "You tell them if they want to do business with Ferdinand T. Briscoe, then they're going to have to deliver more than promises."
Wiping his brow, he stormed out.
"Promises."
The word emptied her with the eviscerating deftness of a gutting blade. She had signed over $1,000 check to a man she had known for only a few weeks. He had her money, and all she had was a promise.
"I'm a fool,"
she thought, beginning to whisper.
"A pathetic, ignorant fool. Always thinking I'm so smart, just getting into one mess after another, always thinking I'm so strong, so tough. And then what do I do but fall for the first man who pays me the slightest bit of attention, the slightest shred? Oh, God, what am I going to do?"
The office door burst open, and Mr. Briscoe rushed back in from the warehouse, demanding to know what was wrong. What was that moaning? What happened? Who said what, what, what? Sobbing into her hands, she couldn't speak, couldn't admit that she had risked everything she had ever worked for, her house, Alice's education, her own reputation.
"I'm such a fool," she wept. "Such a goddamn fool."
Mr. Briscoe wanted her to call Norm to drive her home. "Alice, then," he said when she shook her head, gasping that Norm was at work himself. No, she wasn't going home. She couldn't afford to lose a day's pay, especially now. Mr. Briscoe assured her it would be a day off with pay, but that was even more painful. No, sir. She hadn't taken charity before, and she wasn't about to start now. She'd stay right here at this desk and do her work come hell or high water.
"Marie, you need,"
Mr. Briscoe was saying when the telephone rang.
"Briscoe's Sporting Goods,"
she answered in a ragged voice, before transferring the call to Don in the repair shop. Mr. Briscoe backed into the doorway.
"Look, Marie."
"I'm fine,"
she insisted, tears running down her face as she began to type, fingers scurrying over the keys, her hand shooting up to bat back the carriage return with increasing vehemence.
"I'm going to be just fine,"
she sobbed as the door closed. After that, everything she did or said was tinged with a sadness so palpable it hung from her shoulders like a leaden cloak, causing her to stoop, pitching her forward with her head down, swishing behind her in a chorus of baleful sighs. She had been tricked, betrayed, swindled. Twice, when Lester had called for Alice, she had almost asked to speak to his father. This was clearly a matter for the police, but she was too ashamed. Benji and Norm were eating supper with their mother's untouched plate on the table between them. Without a word, she had jumped up a few minutes ago and run upstairs to her room. Norm scowled as he cut his chicken, but Benji could tell he was determined to ignore what was happening. Benji glanced back at the darkening stairs. Every day the sun set a minute sooner. In a few more weeks, summer would be over. What if Omar Duval wasn't back by then, and she was still this sad? What would she do if she found out? Again, he tried to push from his thoughts the image of Early lying at the edge of the pig farm, with the woods beginning to grow over him. The worst of it now was the double-pronged certainty, not only of the corpse, but of how quickly and completely its connection to Duval would destroy his mother.
"You think Omar's ever coming back?"
he asked.
"Nah,"
Norm said, spearing a chicken wing from his mother's plate.
"You kidding? That asshole's long gone."
"How do you know?"
"I know. Don't worry."
"Come on, Norm, tell me. How do you know? Did you do something?" "You did, didn't you?"
"Let's just say I looked into it."
"Come on, Norm, tell me."
All right, but don't say anything.
His voice lowered. Norm leaned close.
You know that Bernadette Mansaw, right? Well, Weeb got his father's work ID, and we dressed Tommy up in one of his father's suits, and he went up there to Mansaw's place, and he says he's a government VD inspector, and he's tracking down Duval. And she goes nuts. VD, she's screaming, and we're out in the hall listening. VD, Jesus Christ. So then she says, that bastard, I gave him $100, and then the next thing I know, he's calling me from Connecticut. So then Tommy figures, what the hell, while he's there, you know, he might as well. So he says, well, there's something else, ma'am. I have to know the names of all your sex partners in the last 5 years. And she starts telling him, Jesus, naming guys like Billy Tides and clearly from the bowling alley. But then he went too far. He looks up and he says, oh, and by the way, were those blowjobs or normal? And that's when she flipped out and told him to go fuck himself.
Norm's head bobbed over the table as he tried to muffle his laughter.
Yeah, Benji said. But maybe Omar's coming back. You don't know. Come on, jerk. Figure it out. He obviously ripped the slut off for $100 and then took off. And besides, even if he does come back, she'll probably kill him or something.
He didn't say anything. The house seemed vastly, precariously still, as if an exterior wall had just fallen, and if anyone dared move or speak, the rest would follow. Norm peered at him.
You don't want him back here, do you, Benj?
No. He glanced at her plate, her crooked chair wrenched from the table, all the emptiness here.
But Mom does. You know Mom, she's all screwed up. She doesn't know what the hell she wants.
She wants to be happy, that's all. His eyes stung, and he could not swallow against the lump in his throat that was studded with lies and denial.
Well, have I got news for you? Nothing's going to make her happy. You got that? Nothing.
He wouldn't argue, but he knew it wasn't true. He'd seen how she was with Duval, the high color of her skin, the light in her eyes, the ease of her laughter. No matter what Duval was, he was good for his mother. And right now, that was more important than anything. For the last mile along the winding country road, Roy Gold's estate was enclosed by a high brick wall that had been painted black. The brick of the huge ivy-covered house, however, had been left in its natural state, as had the moss-chinked veranda that overlooked a large pond flecked with lily pads. In the soft light of sunset, the pond glowed a warm, shimmering green. Omar Duval turned from the dining room window and took his place at the table among the 12 executive candidates who had been invited to dinner this last night of training. On the walls above the raised white wainscoting had been painted a vivid fox-hunting scene that wended among delicate trees, past dark ponds and distant misty hills. The red-jacketed hunters hunched over their horses, most in full gallop around the room to a far corner, where a circle of agitated dogs strained toward a small fox. The fox crouched, ready to dart into a crevice beneath a large rock. As Omar's eyes raced around the mural, he fully expected to see a horse suddenly rear back, whinnying, as its rider raised a strident bugle to his lips. Howling, the dogs would pounce, and there in the snarling, snapping blur of pursuit, his breath quickened as he imagined the fox slithering down the hole, bellying through the damp, hollow darkness, the safety of the tunnel beyond.
"I know exactly what you're doing, Omar," said Roy Gold, startling him. "You can feel it, can't you?"
He patted his chest.
"That's a good sign," he said with a wink.
Now some of the other men made a point of staring up at the mural, their attention focused on the hunters rather than the quarry, the hunted. The door to the kitchen swung open, onto a young woman in a black dress and white lace apron. She pushed a wheeled brass tureen from which she began to serve consommé. Duval sat between a retired mailman from Paducah, Kentucky, and a grocer from Albany, New York. The grocer leaned forward to confide in the mailman that, in spite of company policy, he planned to retail Presto products on his own store shelves.
"I don't know, Cal," the mailman said out of the side of his mouth. "Like Roy Gold says, it's not that kind of product. Presto's a people product." "Hell, I got people up the gooch," the grocer snorted.
Duval sat back stiffly and cleared his throat so that no one would think him party to such ignorant dinner conversation.
It's a word-of-mouth product, the mailman continued, his arms on the table as he spoke past Omar. Now you take your fabs, your tides, your ivories, your joys. Those are all Madison Avenue products, but Presto's a different product. It's different marketing. It needs a hands-on sell, and that's just the way it is, Cal. No two ways about it.
Hey, all I know is I got shelf space, and now I got product,
the grocer chuckled with a sly nod at Omar.
And with a 75% markup, it don't take no genius to appreciate my situation.
Voices dwindled and spoons clinked as one by one the men began to eat. The maid was still ladling out the broth, his hands folded on the edge of the table. Omar waited for everyone to be served. At the end of the long table, almost obscured by the ornate candelabra, Roy Gold also waited. He was a small man, with glowing sculpted cheeks and even features. His blonde hair was closely trimmed, his hazel eyes clear, his gaze direct, his nails buffed, his navy blazer a perfect fit. In Gold's presence, Omar always felt sloppy and sprawling. He would start tucking in his shirt and hitching up his pants and buffing the toes of his shoes on the back of his pant leg. Gold was in charge of every fiber of his being. Omar still couldn't believe his good fortune in linking up with Gold. The man was a marketing genius with more dynamism, more compassion than anyone he'd ever met before. Uniquely, Gold's goal wasn't just to make money, but to share that opportunity with men like himself, bright, ambitious visionaries. As the maid steered the tureen into the kitchen, Gold took up his spoon, and then so did Omar. He noted how erectly Gold sat, never hunching over his bowl or slurping like the others. He noted how Gold ate from the side of his spoon, always refilling it away from himself, and so he did the same. Imagine, there were even rules for eating soup. In this complicated universe, it was the ordinary things he found most exciting. Conversations rose and fell around him. His breast swelled with joy, with exuberance. There was no task he could not master. Nothing seemed past his grasp. Beyond this moment, a finger's reach away, like jewels in a glass case, glimmered a life of privilege and honor. He had come this far. Yes, he had. Alert even in the depths of fear and the pain of betrayal, he had not despaired. Instead, had chosen another path, breaking off a lilac branch as he fled, stooping to retrieve an empty matchbook cover from the dust. Yes. Yes, he had come this far, and most surely for a reason. All at once the voices surged, and he looked around to see Cal pick up his bowl and drink the rest of his broth. Poor, poor fellow, he thought. Such a minor man. When everyone was done, Gold stood. With a knife blade, he tapped his water goblet, and it tinkled like a crystal bell.
"Gentlemen," he called in a pleasant voice. "May I have your attention, please?"
Omar saw how his smile radiated genuine affection.
"For just a few minutes, I assure you."
"Hey, it's your place, Roy, so you go take all the time you want,"
called Johnny Biggs with a hearty laugh. Biggs was a carpet installer from Detroit whose bad knees had ordained a new line of work. His life savings as well as his mother's had been invested in Presto.
"Hear that?"
he'd asked Omar during the cocktail hour, raising each leg up and down.
"That's cartilage crunching." "Well, I appreciate your patience, Johnny," said Gold, "and your forthrightness, which is a trait every one of you men possess. And it's why you're here tonight, why you've come this far, why you've been chosen over countless others to be executive trainees in what has become the fastest-growing company on the face of the earth."
He looked up and down the table.
"Quite a statement to make, isn't it, about a company that's only 4 years old? But it's the truth. No matter what you'll hear to the contrary, no matter what the cynics say, and believe me, there are a lot of those. Oh, my Lord, are there ever. A cynic on every corner. You'll meet them every day, everywhere you go. It doesn't work, they'll tell you. It can't work, they'll tell you. It defies logic, they'll tell you. It's an unbalanced system, they'll tell you. It's malarkey, they'll say, out-and-out hokey.
Roy Gold paced the length of the table, stopping now at the other end.
"Is this malarkey?"
he asked, gesturing from the coffee service on the mahogany buffet to the dramatic mural, the sweep of his hand stirring the chandelier's crystal pendants to a tremble of fiery flashes.
"Is it hokey? You see it. I earned it. Does it defy logic that a man who's willing to sell an excellent product at a fair price can have all this? Does it defy logic that a man can love success so much that he wants, no, I take that back, needs, must share it with others?"
He came down the other side of the table now, trailing a fragrance that reminded Omar of Marie's freshly hung laundry, warm in the morning sun.
"Of course it doesn't," Gold said, turning abruptly. "But it shocks people, because they don't know how to take me. I speak a plain language, gentlemen. There's an easy way and a hard way, a right way and a wrong way, and shame on me, but I don't know any other way to play except fair. You see, I grew up real poor. It was just me and my father and my mother. But you see, being poor didn't bother me. Going to bed with my stomach growling some nights didn't bother me. Wearing a grown man's clothes cut down to boy's size didn't bother me. No, what really, really bothered me was not having any brothers and sisters. What really hurt was that my father never spoke to me and my mother unless he had to. And then what nearly tore me apart was losing my mother when I was just 15 years old. That was the worst impoverishment. All my life, the thing I've wanted more than anything else is a family. For me, that's all there is."
He gestured around the room, which was so still not a man blinked or seemed to breathe. Johnny Biggs still held the roll he had taken one bite from.
"That's what this is all about. I can't stand being alone. I have this yearning, not for power, not for money, but for the strength and support of a family. For community. Come unity. That's what this company is. That's what I'm all about. That's what the cynics can't understand. And gentlemen, that's the way it's got to be for you, too. You've got to develop this need, this unquenchable thirst for the interrelationship and love and trust and comfort of a family. Support one another. Reach out. Bring others in. Share your knowledge, your expertise, your market. Build an executive network every bit as strong, as durable, as caring as a family. Because let me tell you, gentlemen, that's where the future of this nation is. That's where my future is. In you. My family."
Roy Gold returned to his chair and sat down. He smoothed his napkin in his lap as every man leaped up, clapping and cheering. Johnny Biggs put down his roll and whistled. Once again, Omar felt this expansion in his chest, in his throat, behind his eyes, and now, for the first time, he not only knew its source, but could give it a name, this hunger, this limitless hunger. Omar Duval's first stop was at Bernadette's. The day had been long and mean with heat, and, he supposed, the constant whining of her rashy-faced, shirtless children. They clung to her legs as she spoke over the chain of the lock. She wouldn't let him in. She refused to come down and see his new car.
"What's wrong, baby?" he pleaded. "Please, please tell me."
He reached in to run his finger down her nose, but she jerked back with a hissed demand for her money.
"Little bitch."
He gripped the tacky doorframe and clenched his teeth. All the way back from Connecticut, he'd fantasized their lovemaking after almost 2 weeks apart. In his jacket pocket were the black lace garter belt and bra he'd bought her in Hartford. And here he stood, horny as hell, pockets bulging, and she wouldn't even let him in. He should have called first, he thought, realizing now that her bedroom door was closed. She had some other guy in there, probably some kid. Remembering what she'd said about Norm sent a chill up his spine, and he stepped back, gesturing to let her know he understood that it was okay. It wasn't her fault. He had no right to be angry or possessive. After all, who understood human weakness and need better than he did?
"When's a good time to come back?" he whispered.
"Never,"
she snapped. And I'm telling you, if you don't get my money back, I'm going straight to the cops.
Why? What's wrong?
She released the chain and stepped into the hallway, dragging the little girls attached to her, one on each leg. She closed the door quietly and told him about the U.S. government syphilis guy coming to warn her about him. Jabbing her finger in his face, she said she didn't want him near her or the kids ever again.
Do you understand? Do you?
She spat. That creep talking like that about her private life, like she was just some piece of trash, was the worst thing that had ever happened to her.
Do you understand? Not just the worst, but the most humiliating, the most disgusting.
Listen to me.
He grabbed her arm to calm her down.
What are you talking about? What man? What did he look like? Was he a Negro?
He was white, she said, pulling away. He was a big guy, young, with a purplish birthmark under his nose. He had a U.S. government badge, and his ID said he was a VD investigator for the Department of Public Health.
You lying little...
He grabbed her again, wrenching her close.
Get your fucking hand off me!
Chin out, eyes narrowed, she held his stare.
Now!
He let her go. Luther and the old man, he could feel them in this. His eyes darted up and down the corridor, which seemed darker with their nearness and the dull tenacity of their mission. An itchy sweat trickled down his neck. Whining to go back inside, the little girls tugged at their mother.
I want my money back. Every penny of it, she demanded.
He touched her face and tried to smile.
That's impossible, little Miss Mansaw.
He told her that he had already purchased her distributorship and her product line.
You can go to hell, you and your goddamn soap, she said, batting away his hand.
I imagine I will, someday, he said, grinning. But first, I expect to be delivering your product to you in approximately 2 to 3 weeks, Ms. Mansaw.
I want my money,
she called down the hallway after him.
I don't want any of your fucking product, your fucking soap.
His next stop was the boarding house, where he would go through the judge's files and compile a list of potential customers. He would personally call on everyone he could find and sell them a franchise. It was amazing how quickly people could be disarmed with just a few vital facts. Your cousin Lena in Detroit, the stone house at the lake that your aunt left you and your brother took you to court for. People were just dying to find someone they could trust, an intimate, someone who not only understood, but knew things without having to be told. And he didn't regard it in any way as taking advantage or preying on their troubles, because the truth was, he cared about people. He really did, even when they turned on him. It pained him to see anyone hurt. There were still nights when he could not close his eyes, but what images of Early came to mind. That most headstrong, stubborn, and selfish young man who, in a very real sense, had been the instrument of his own harm. And of this he had no doubt, none whatsoever. He patted his temples and neck dry, then knocked on the screen door. May Mayo held her finger to her lips as she gestured him into the parlor, away from her sister. In the kitchen, Claire sat at the table, shelling peas as polka music blared from the radio.
"Sister doesn't want you here," May whispered. "She thinks all the things we've been missing are your fault."
"Things?"
"The shower hose and the bath mat and the white urn lamp and her Wedgwood plates."
"Well, why on earth would I take those?"
"I don't know," she said. "But then those women started calling."
"What women?"
he asked, knowing it must have been Bernadette and Marie.
"They never give their names. They just say it's about business. I didn't tell them a thing," May assured him. "But Sister wants to call the police."
"The police?"
He coughed against his prickly throat.
"The police?"
"Yes,"
May Mayo whispered, glancing past him to make sure Claire was still in the kitchen.
"She thinks you're a flim-flam man."
"A what?"
he whispered back.
"A flim-flam man."
"What's a flim-flam man?"
"A sharpie, a crook, like a gypsy."
The noon news broadcast began to play loudly on the kitchen radio now, and the announcer's deep voice steadied him. There were higher powers here that would protect him. He had suffered enough failure and disappointment, so now must be the time of his good fortune and triumph. Surely it was due him. Surely he had earned it. He reminded himself that it was not happenstance that had delivered him here, but some magnetizing force. But now, Sister says you can't stay. I feel just terrible, Mr. Duval, what with your government connections and all. But there's nothing I can do.
Well, there's one thing you can keep on doing, Miss Mayo, and that's don't tell people anything at all.
He looked over both shoulders.
There are spies around, Miss Mayo.
Her hand flew to her mouth.
Oh, I was afraid of something like that. Spies! A fine kettle of fish. Especially now, ever since the judge passed on, Sister's had me walking a very tight rope here.
The delicate little woman gestured him down so she could whisper at his ear.
Nursing home? The least little thing, and she starts dialing them. So I've got to be careful, Mr. Duval. Very, very careful.
Of course, Omar said, heading for the front door with May at his heels in a tremulous flutter. In the front hall, he stopped suddenly and looked down at her.
Have you ever been in business for yourself, Miss Mayo?
Oh, no, she tittered at the thought. I leave all that up to Claire. She's the one with the head for business, the practical one.
She looked around before whispering,
I'm the flighty one, Mr. Duval, the dreamer.
Well, maybe it's time to change, Miss Mayo. Maybe it's time to take charge of your life. I mean, I find it quite appalling that a lovely woman like yourself has to live in fear of being railroaded into a nursing home. I mean that, Miss Mayo.
Her hairy chin quivered.
Well, thank you, Mr. Duval. I appreciate your concern.
I'm very fond of you, Miss Mayo, and I'd like to help you, if you'd let me.
She had been staring up at him.
Yes,
she said.
I'd like you to help me. I really would.
Well, it's a business proposition, an investment, an opportunity to be independent, Miss Mayo, and to make your own decisions about your own life.
Marie was hanging towels on the line when Omar came down the driveway. Her hair was a mess, and she had clothespins in her mouth, and the front of her blouse was wet from the two loads of bundled wash she'd just carried out here. As she turned back to the line, the sharp grass scratched her ankles. She hadn't shaved her legs or underarms in days. The wash was piled on a paper bag because the laundry basket was coated with green slime from sitting outside all week, and there the lawnmower lay, rusting in the tall, weedy grass. This wasn't the way she wanted things to be. She wanted to seem strong and in control when he returned, or if he returned. That one word, ballast to every hopeful surge, if.
If, and here he was.
She was amazed, amazed, and now in her relief so confused she couldn't think straight, couldn't think at all. Could just continue this task, this vital, centering chore.
Marie,
he stood grinning at her.
You look wonderful,
he said,
a sight for sore, sore eyes.
She grabbed another towel, squeezing it so hard her fingers hurt.
Oh, here, he said,
patting one jacket pocket, then another.
I got this for you.
He pulled out a small framed photograph.
It's me shaking hands with Roy Gold.
He offered it uneasily.
I thought you'd like it.
Her hands trembled as she pinned together the corners of two towels. He cleared his throat, then studied the picture with a frown, as if noticing certain details for the first time.
Oh, yes. This was at the ceremony.
He held it even closer.
In fact, that's your certificate of franchise he's handing me.
She bent down for another towel, but he snatched it from the pile and hung it on the line.
I've missed you terribly,
he said, shaking out another towel.
You did?
She asked, her chest suddenly daggered by all the pain she had suppressed or denied. And here it was, here he was, tearing her apart. No, no, no matter what he said or did, no matter how he explained it, she could not live this way again, leashed to a man's promises, knowing his every word so much by heart as she fell asleep, analyzing every sentence,
that she would wake up hours later, stuck on the exact same word, wondering, had he said this while meaning that? Had he forgotten? Had he just been too busy? Had she misunderstood? Oh, surely she had misunderstood, because he would not lie, because there were times when he seemed to care for her so, because she had tried so hard in so many ways, because she wanted, needed to be loved, because she needed, because.
Oh, you have no idea, he sighed. Sometimes in the lectures it got so bad I could barely concentrate.
He glanced back at her.
I just kept thinking about you and the children and this yard and the house, and I'd be wondering how Benji's swimming was going, and was Alice still coming home so exhausted every night, and did Noam still hate my guts? Well, not hate, he chuckled. Maybe resent, which I don't think will last too long once he sees my new car, which you are going to love, Marie. It drives like a dream. It just hums along. I can't wait to see you in it. Truly, it befits you. Oh, Marie, I just want the best, the very best for you and the children.
Arms folded, she watched him hang the last few towels and washcloths. Every time he bent over, his jacket and shirt hiked up his back. He'd obviously gained weight, while she'd eaten so little this last week that now even the smell of food sickened her. She started toward the house.
"You forgot your picture," he said, following her to the door.
"No," she said when he reached for the knob.
"Can't I come in?"
His eyes widened.
"I need to see you. I need to talk to you."
"We'll have to talk out here," she said.
"What's wrong, Marie?"
"I want my money back." Saying it made her knees sag.
"Why?"
He looked stunned.
"Why?"
he asked again.
"I trusted you in a way I've never trusted anyone in my whole life, and now I feel like such a fool."
"Marie,"
he put his hands on her shoulders.
"What in God's name is going on here?"
His head shot up and he looked past her.
"Has someone been around here besmirching my good name?" "He has, hasn't he? And you believed it. How could you? How could you? I'm very disappointed."
No one had been around. She had no idea what he was talking about, and yet, oddly enough, she found herself on the defensive. She explained how his two-week absence had made her lose trust in him, and now he grew even more upset, wringing his hands and pacing back and forth on the driveway.
"What could I do? I had no choice. It was business. Every waking moment was nothing but seminars and charts and workshops. I don't know what to say, Marie. I mean, you of all people, you know what this opportunity means to me, to us."
He threw up his hands, and with his back to her, he groaned.
"I don't know. I don't know what to say."
He looked around.
"I thought you had such faith in me. I guess that was my mistake. I just assumed you believed me. I've been alone so long, I'm just not used to verifying every move. I'm sorry. I had no idea you were so unhappy and so afraid. I feel like such an ass."
"I didn't know where you were."
"But I told you where I was."
He came back and stood by the steps. His eyes were bloodshot and weary.
"Not really. You never really said exactly where, and then you didn't call again. And I got very nervous."
Her voice broke.
"Well, I'm here now."
He touched her arm.
"You don't have to be nervous anymore."
She closed her eyes. She had accused him so many times in her thoughts that now in his presence there seemed nothing more to say.
"Look what I have."
He was unrolling a piece of parchment.
"Your certificate of franchise. See?"
he said, pointing as he presented it to her.
"That's Roy Gold's signature."
She looked up, her heart pounding.
"But it only says one franchise. I gave you money for two. That's what you said."
He grabbed it back, and his look of shock frightened her.
"Damn,"
he said, examining the document.
"It's a good thing you caught that. It got right by me." It's just one of those clerical errors a phone call'll clear up in 2 seconds flat. He sighed. You don't believe that either, do you?
I want to believe you, she said.
He leaned so close that she thought he was going to kiss her right out here in full view of Jesse Klubach's kitchen window.
Can I come in then?
He asked. So far, Marie had managed to ignore Norm's sullenness as he hunched over his plate. Actually, it was Benji who was putting a strain on the conversation right now. She wasn't even sure what Omar had just said, just some light-hearted remark, but Benji was doubled over, his high-pitched laughter nervous and throbbing with eagerness.
"Somebody better do something. I think he's choking," Norm mumbled, not even looking up.
Benji's laughter ceased so abruptly that his mouth still twitched. He kept blinking, and his hand shook as he cut his hamburg patty into tiny pieces. In the fork-clinking silence, her eyes met Norm's. Omar slapped the table with both hands.
"Well, what do you say, boys? Who wants to drive my brand-new Cadillac?"
Norm's head shot up.
"New?"
Omar chuckled.
"Well, new for me's new enough."
"Go ahead, Norm," she urged. Omar was trying so hard. It was true, he wasn't used to the complexities of family life. "Just go for a quick spin, why don't you?"
"I can't."
Norm sucked loudly on his cornless cob.
"I'm going somewhere."
"I wish I could drive,"
Benji said, looking between her and Omar with that forced smile.
"Yeah, and that'll be another disaster, just like swimming," Norm said with a smirk for her benefit.
After Benji's fall into the pool, she hadn't made him go back. She knew she should have. She'd always made Alice and Norm face their fears, but with Omar gone, she'd been too frightened herself, too drained.
"There's a time to reap and a time to sow,"
Omar was saying,
"and this just may not be Benji's time to swim."
He smiled at Benji.
"But it'll come, mark my words. When the time's right, he'll be ready."
She looked at Benji, wishing it was so, but he was too much his father's son. Outside, the Klubach's dog had been barking. Now the barking intensified with a sudden knock on the back door.
"I never even heard them," Norm said, jumping up.
Omar leaned back and opened the door. Weeb Miller and Tommy Mullins glanced in nervously at Norm, who started toward them.
"Well, hello, young men. Come in, come in. My name," he said, extending his hand, "is Omar Duval."
"Nice to meet you,"
Weeb said, blushing as they shook hands. He introduced himself as Lawrence, a name Marie hadn't heard him use in years. The other boy, who was as tall as Omar, was a jiggle of soft flesh. Though she hadn't seen him in a long time, Marie recognized him by the purple birthmark on his upper lip.
"This is Tommy Mullins," Weeb said, introducing his friend, who nodded and rubbed his arm as he shuffled forward to shake Omar's hand.
His parents had sent him away to prep school, but she could see it obviously hadn't had any maturing effect on Tommy, who stammered halting replies to Omar's pleasant questions. He kept glancing miserably at Norm.
"We better get going," Norm said.
He flipped a cookie and Weeb caught it.
"You look like an athlete, young man,"
Omar said. Weeb shrugged and shook his head in flattered denial.
"Norm's the jock. I just kind of goof around."
"Well, be that as it may, you've got one of those frames that's all muscle and tendon,"
Omar said. Mouth agape, Norm rolled his eyes.
"We'd better get going," he said again.
But Omar was asking Weeb how he'd been spending his summer.
"Sleeping,"
Weeb said, laughing. Then, with a glance at Marie, he added,
"I got 10 lawns I cut."
"That's why you're in such good shape,"
Omar said. And now he asked Tommy.
"I work for my father," Tommy said. "He has the bakery on Beacom Street."
"Yeah, he's the head muffin man, can't you tell?"
Weeb laughed with a jab at Tommy's belly.
"Hey, somebody's got to do quality control," Tommy sniffed.
And they all laughed, all but Norm.
"Muffins just happen to be my specialty."
"And specialization, as we all know, is the future now, isn't it?" Omar said. "I myself am involved in cleaning products.
the marketing of soap and other various cleansers and detergents, both commercial and domestic.
That must be interesting, Weeb said, shuffling his feet. He and Tommy Mullins looked at Norm, who waited at the door.
You know, it is, Omar mused. It's not the product, it's the people you meet. Let me tell you, young man, you ever get a few dollars together and want to be your own boss? You just give me a call. Now, I mean that. Seriously. Oh, your mothers and fathers. Maybe you could even give them these, he said, taking pamphlets from his breast pocket and handing them to the boys. Tell me, Lawrence, what line of work's your dad in?
He's a federal VD inspector, Weeb laughed.
The boys exchanged glances.
Well, isn't that interesting,
Omar said. He was staring at Norm.
I wouldn't imagine you'd find too many of them around, he said to Norm.
Marie felt bad. Omar obviously thought the boys were putting one over on him.
I don't know, Norm said, glancing past Omar, who continued to stare at him. Come on, we gotta go now, he said to Weeb and Tommy, who hurried after him.
The look of dread on Benji's face startled her, and she realized he was afraid of losing Omar, afraid Norm would drive him away. Steve Miller really is a VD inspector, she told Omar, and Benji winced.
Is he now?
Omar mused as he watched them through the window. He's always kept it real low key, but the boys are right at that age. I think they have a lot of fun with it.
He nodded, turning. I'll bet they do.
He must Benji's hair.
I'll just bet they do now.
Later, when Benji had gone to bed, she and Omar sat on the couch watching television. With Omar's arms around her and her head on his shoulder, she closed her eyes, grateful for this rare time alone before Norm brought Alice home from work.
You're a wonderful woman, Omar sighed.
As she leaned closer, her hand pressed down on a metal ring. Thinking something was caught in the cushion, she gave it a tug. She had pulled a black lace garter belt from his pocket.
Oh, Lord, he groaned. Now you've seen it.
What is it? There was a store tag attached.
So now I have to give it to you. Here, he said,
also removing a black bra from the same pocket.
I bought them, but then I was too embarrassed to give them to you. So, here,
he said, holding them out with his eyes closed.
Oh, no. Oh, dear,
she giggled, dangling the bra in front of her.
Now, don't make me feel any more foolish than I already do, he pleaded,
his head turned.
It's so big, she burst out laughing. It's huge.
Well, pardon my inadequate powers of estimation, he said, turning back. But how would I know?
His mouth moved close to hers.
How on earth would I know, dear lady?
Benji was halfway down the stairs when he stopped, surprised to see Omar asleep on the couch, where he must have spent the night. Take him somewhere, he heard his mother saying, as she stood at the counter wrapping sandwiches for herself and Norm to take to work.
Where?
Norm asked from the table, his mouth full of cereal.
I don't know. Anywhere. You're his brother, and you never spend any time with him. He's alone too much.
Then why are you letting him quit swimming lessons?
Norm shot back.
Just because he said so?
Wincing, Benji froze on the steps.
Because he's a nervous wreck, his mother said. He almost drowned.
And next time he probably will if he doesn't learn how. He's got to, especially if he's afraid.
Mom, you're the one that taught me that.
Look, Norm, right now I can only do so much. Do you understand?
No, I don't. Not about something as important as that, anyway, Norm said, his voice rising.
In the pause, Benji held his breath.
Okay, I'll tell you what, his mother said.
After work today, you take Benji to the lake, and you teach him how to swim. Her car keys jingled, and she opened the door.
The lake? But at night, just couples go there, Mom. Dates.
Just do it, she ordered, then rushed out to the car.
Yeah, so you can do it with a peddler, Norm muttered.
hurrying after her so he wouldn't have to walk to work. Benji glanced down at Omar, embarrassed to see him awake. He must have heard what Norm had just said.
"Come here, son,"
Omar said as he sat up.
"You know, there's other things to do at the lake besides swimming."
He reached for his pants and took $5 bills from his pocket.
"Here,"
he said, winking.
"Maybe with this you can call your own shots."
It was late afternoon. Alice had left for work, and Benji was in the backyard. There was still an hour left before he met Norm at his mother's office for their trip to the lake. Over in the Klubox yard, Louie and a friend were on their knees pushing trucks through the grass. Klubox's dog came toward him, limping the way he did when he first got up.
"Good boy," Benji said, rubbing his flanks.
If it was his dog, he'd let him live in the house and not outside all year long. He threw a stick, and the dog dove into the deep grass, then raced back with it. He found a dingy tennis ball in the washing machine box, and he threw it high in the air. It hit the ground and bounced, and the dog leaped straight up and caught it. He took the slimy ball from the dog's mouth and threw it as far as he could toward the woods. The dog shot after it.
"Look at that,"
he thought, smiling. All he needed was some attention to make him think he was a young dog again. A few minutes passed, then the dog came trotting back with something flopping in his mouth. Stepping closer, he saw that it was a shoe, a stained leather shoe. Early's shoe, he knew from the smell. "Give it to me," he cried, trying to pry it from the struggling dog's muzzle, but the dog wanted to play.
"I said give it to me," he repeated,
and when the dog continued to pull away, he slapped the side of his head as hard as he could. The dog growled and he yanked away the shoe. The smell was so disgusting that he had to hold his breath to keep from passing out as he threw it into the garage and locked the door. When he turned around, the dog was gone.
"You hit my dog!"
Louie was shouting from his yard.
"I'm going to tell my mother on you, and you're going to be in big trouble."
Convinced that the dog had returned to the woods for the dead man's other shoe, Benji ran down the street. "No, no, no," he panted, needing to outrun that dark mass of swelling flesh, the secret rooted in his brain. He didn't stop until he was downtown. He turned the corner to the sporting goods store, grateful that Mr. Briscoe's car wasn't in the parking lot. He hurried through the dim warehouse to his mother's office. Astrid smiled as he stepped inside. In the spill of fluorescent light, she was a dazzle of red lips, glistening skin, and platinum hair. The top of her sundress was a weave of gold-threaded red straps. Her desk was a colorful litter of plastic flowers, statuettes, paperweights, and pictures. On Astrid's side of the filing cabinet, there was a mosaic of movie magazine clippings of Bobby Darin, who had bought her a drink once in Las Vegas.
"So, Benji, I heard the good news," she said,
punching numbers into her adding machine. The long strip of paper curled onto the floor.
"School's opening a month early. Next week, I think they said."
Pausing, she glanced up.
"Geez, didn't anyone tell you?"
Stunned, he shook his head.
"Off. They probably just didn't want to spoil your last few days of freedom."
She pulled the strip of paper close and examined it, then jumped up and wiggled over to him on her high red heels.
"Geez, that went over like a lead balloon," she said, placing her hands on his shoulders.
Even in heels, she wasn't that much taller than he was. Her breath hit his face with the warmth of spicy flowers.
"I was kidding. I was just kidding."
She shook him, and he tried to smile. She opened the top drawer of her desk and slid out a box of pink peppermints.
"Don't be so polite," she said when he only took one. "Here," she said, slipping four more into his pants pocket.
Then, hearing his mother come through the warehouse, she scurried into her chair. She winked, and he could feel himself blushing. Right after his mother came back into the office, Norm arrived, looking as hot and tired as his mother. Benji could see her grow more irritated as Astrid kept interrupting her. Fearing a blow-up, he fixed on his mother's every word, nodding intently as if his concentration might shield Astrid. His mother was explaining that he and Norm were to eat at the hot dog stand on the beach and not at the hotel because that food was too expensive.
"What the hey? Live it up," Astrid laughed. "Don't listen to her. Have some fun."
The blanket's in the car, his mother continued, trying to ignore her. Here's your money.
Thanks, Norm said, looking down at the $2. It'll be a big night.
Don't look so miserable, Astrid said, throwing her arm over his shoulder. Maybe you'll meet some cute girls. Do a little dancing, a little stargazing.
She laughed. Remember now, Norm, you're going to teach Benji how to swim, his mother said.
Well, I hope that's not all he's going to teach him, she said with a wink at Norm and a tweak of Benji's nose. Want Auntie Astrid to come too? She asked,
and Norm burst out laughing, his face reddening. Go ahead now. His mother steered them to the door. Astrid ran into the warehouse after them.
Hey, Marie, I just thought, my party tonight. You said you couldn't come because of the kids, but they're going out, so now you can. I got tons of food, and you'd really like the wire plant people. I mean it. They're all just a heck of a nice bunch. And besides, you'll really bail me out if you come. Somehow I got more guys than girls coming, and Bobby's just going to shit. Oh, excuse me, boys, your Auntie Astrid slipped. But he's going to think I did it on purpose. I know he is. And really, I wasn't even thinking, you know, boy, girl, or anything like that. I just went around inviting people I liked. And I'll be darned, most of them turned out to be guys. So will you come? Please, please, pretty please with sugar on top.
She clasped her hands under her chin, pouting like a child. Astrid, if you don't mind, I have to tell my son something, his mother said with a cold stare.
Oh, yeah, sure, she said, backing into the office. I'll be in here.
She gave a little wave, and Benji waved back. Why don't you go to her party, Mom? Norm asked when the door closed. Maybe you'll meet some nice guy, some nice people, he quickly added. I have to learn the business tonight, she said with an odd, startled look. Omar's going to teach me.
I'd like to know what the hell this is all about, Norm said as they waited for the light to change.
He drummed his fingers on the side-view mirror. I don't know, Benji said with a shrug, trying to seem as peeved as Norm, when actually he couldn't have been happier. He liked being with his brother. His troubles seemed very distant right now.
I'll tell you what it is, Norm said.
The light turned green and he shifted from park to drive. If they idled too long in gear, the engine would stall. The car lurched forward and Norm banged the wheel.
She wants you out of the house so she can be alone with that fucking peddler.
To learn the business, Benji said, letting his arm trail through the wind.
Yeah, she'll learn the business all right, the slimy no-good bastard. Someday I'm going to put my fist right down that no-good fucker's mouth.
He could feel Norm's eyes on him, but he kept staring over the dashboard.
I can't believe this, Norm said. I could be at Weeb's right now. Instead, I got to chauffeur you around.
We can go to Weeb's. I don't care, he said, and Norm groaned.
Hey, you used to always get carsick, didn't you? Norm asked.
No, you did, he said. And then when I saw you get sick, I'd get sick.
But that's it, Norm cried. I can drop you off and you can say you almost threw up, so you have to go lay down.
He grinned.
Yeah, what's she gonna do, make you go sit on the steps all night so she and the fucking peddler can be alone?
No, I don't want to.
Why?
Norm's voice cracked. I don't know. I just don't. Actually, there were three reasons. He didn't want to spend the night in bed, he wanted his mother to be alone with Omar, and he wanted to have fun with Norm.
You know, Benji, I think you're probably the most selfish little asshole I've ever known.
Norm's face curdled with disgust. Forget number three, he thought, his head snapping back as Norm hit the gas and they peeled down Main Street. At the lake, Norm parked in the hotel lot. Leaning against the car, he took off his sneakers and stripped down to his bathing suit, which he had worn all day. Grimy from work, he couldn't wait to get into the water. As he came down the grassy slope to the beach with Benji on his heels, he was relieved to see that he didn't know anyone. Most everyone here was older. This was going to be some night. The little creep had deliberately forgotten his bathing suit, and all he kept talking about was food. Norm spread their blanket, then started down toward the water.
Can we eat now?
Benji asked, hurrying after him.
Please, Norm, I'm really hungry. He kept stepping on blankets and tripping over people.
Hey, kid!
Jesus Christ!
Watch it, will you?
Voices cascaded after them.
Shit!
He turned and grabbed Benji's arm. Will you leave me alone? Can't we go eat? I'm starved, Benji begged so desperately that Norm was ashamed.
Soon as I'm done, he promised,
then trotted off down to the pier and dove into the cool water. He swam out to the floating dock, then climbed up and sat on the edge and looked back at the peeling gabled hotel, the bustling beach, and his skinny brother just standing there in pants that were too short, his arms folded, head hunched forward, with the water lapping only inches from his feet. Norm groaned. He still had his sneakers on, the little creep. Tonight would have been perfect. Weeb's parents and his sister Janice weren't going to be home, so they would have been able to drink Mr. Miller's beer and listen to records in the comfort of Weeb's bedroom. Instead, he had Benji on his hands and two lousy bucks for food. Benji waved. He kept waving. Norm refused to wave at him. Finally, he slipped into the water and swam back.
Wait, Norm, wait!
Benji kept yelling as he lurched through the coarse sand to the hot dog stand on the nub of the beach. They stood in line, reading the paper sign that listed the 30 different garnishes. Here, Benji shoved something into his hand.
Where'd you get this?
He demanded, peeling apart the sweaty clutch of bills. He grabbed Benji's arm.
Steal it,
he hissed through a smile for the benefit of the throngs of people around them.
No.
His fingers dug into Benji's armpit.
From Duval, right?
He snarled, and Benji's blank stare was answer enough. He turned away in disgust. The peddler was trying to buy Benji off, and the little creep was just stupid enough and weak enough to fall for it. Since his return, Duval had surged in confidence around them, openly, brazenly embracing their mother, bragging about his mysterious connections and the vague, distant trips he would take her on soon, soon. As soon as this latest deal breaks even, soon as I see my way clear, soon as the market straightens itself out, soon as the big call comes, soon. Even his mother was beginning to sound like him. Everything was soon with her hand on the back of Duval's chair, her gaze focused on the top of his head as if she'd discovered some dazzling truth in the oily morass of his hair, her voice unfolding like tremulous arms to his lies. And lies they were, all lies. There was no Roy Gold, no soap coming, and he'd probably fast-talked that shitty Cadillac off some other desperate woman.
Two dogs with piccalilli and chili beans and a Coke, he told the man behind the counter. What about you? He asked Benji.
The same.
Benji's grin turned his stomach. Didn't he get it? Didn't he see how he was being used by Duval to get to their mother? They sat on their blanket in front of a grove of blue-needled trees. Around them on the beach, couples moved closer to one another as the red sun sank behind the dark mountains. Lifeguards moved along the beach, calling through their megaphones for everyone to come out of the water. Far across the lake, approaching the opposite shore, a small boat cut its motor and drifted silently in the fan-shaped breach between darkness and the last sliver of daylight. Suddenly the light was gone, leaving only a faint pink glow that silhouetted the black trees on the jagged mountain top. They were going to leave at sunset. Benji had agreed to go to Weeb's, but he'd promised to wait in the car. For that favor, Norm said he'd tell their mother that Benji had done well swimming in the lake. They ate with a startling urgency.
I was so hungry, Benji cried. Let's have some more.
Norm paused. He was ready to go now, but one more hot dog sounded good.
I'll get it, he said.
He started to get up, then sank back onto his knees.
How come Duval gave you that money?
I don't know. To be nice, I guess.
Benji shrugged. Norm leaned close now.
Why do you think he's so nice to you?
Because he knows Alice and I are on to him, so he's after you. He needs you on his side.
I see him, the way he looks at you. The way he's always trying to make you laugh or get you to do things with him. Like last night, saying it's okay to quit swimming lessons. Why do you think he did that?
He doesn't care about you, Benji. He doesn't even like you. Can't you tell? To him, you're just Mom's, you know, her weak spot. Don't you get it?
Don't you see how he's using you to get to her? I mean, tonight, right now, this very moment, he's probably fucking the...
Shut up, Norm! You just shut up!
Benji cried, with a shove that reeled him back on his heels. Norm got up and stalked off toward the hot dog stand. It's a good thing there were so many people around, or else he might have beaten the shit out of the goddamn little creep, pushing him like that in front of all these people, the goddamn little bastard. Forget the fucking hot dogs. He'd go back and drag him into the woods and beat the fucking living shit out of the goddamn little prick and teach him once and for all what the fuck loyalty was all about, the little...
Norman,
came a familiar voice, a sweet, sweet voice. Norman Fermoyle. Oh, am I glad to see you. Weeb's sister, Janice Miller, ran toward him with a cigarette in her hand. It didn't matter if Omar liked him or not. The important thing was that Omar loved his mother, Benji thought, as he watched a boy and a girl on the blanket in front of him. The girl had short black hair and a deep tan. She lay on her side, squirming against the boy's thigh. She drew her fingers down his bony chest and up again to his chin. The boy grabbed her arm then and rolled her onto her back. He lay across her chest and kissed her mouth. Benji forced his gaze into the hole he had been digging in the sand. For once so much alone, so accustomed to hours without speaking and days untouched, this intimacy so near was alarming. Now the girl gave a little whoop and tried to wrestle free. The boy laughed and pinned her down. Closing his eyes, Benji tensed, waiting for the moment to turn. The boy would hit her. She would scream. She would cry. And then she would not be able to stop crying. All at once he remembered being a small boy perched on his father's shoulders as he ran out of the thicket where dark vines had snagged his hair. A troubled voice had trailed them through the night.
Benji? Benji! Where is he taking you?
He remembered the whisk of the trees passing between him and his mother's voice, until all he could hear was the deep groan in his father's labored breathing below him as he ran. He didn't know where they had gone that night, or why his father had taken him. He only remembered waking the next morning in a car behind a gray building. There were open garbage barrels and trash-filled cartons piled high against the wall. He remembered being afraid to move or speak under the weight of his father's stale, damp head on his stomach. He remembered his father snoring, and then how suddenly his stubbly face had loomed over him. He remembered his raw, puffy eyes streaked with blood and confusion, and then the terrible grinding of his teeth as he peered suspiciously at his son, as if Benji had lured him there. He remembered being slapped hard and not knowing why. He remembered seeing his father weep and knowing then that it was all right, that it wasn't anything he had done or that anyone had done, that sometimes it just had to be that way. The boy and girl sat up now, facing the beach, with their arms around each other's waist. It was taking Norm a long time to get hot dogs. It would be even darker than this in the woods, he thought, deep in the woods where Early lay. Maybe Klubach's dog thought Early was alive. Maybe he had ripped Early's shirt and pants in an effort to drag Early back to Benji. He sat up and hugged his legs. Maybe one of these days he'd open the door and find Early's body on the back steps staring up at him. And what would he do then? What would Omar do?
My roommate's down there,
Janice Miller pointed toward the bathhouse on the far corner of the beach. The woods behind the bathhouse were where everyone went to make out or drink.
She met some guy and she hasn't been back since,
Janice said, then took a long, deep drag on her cigarette. Norm cleared his throat, wishing he could do the same with his brain. Here he sat on the beach, finally alone with Weeb's beautiful sister, and there was nothing on this earth he could think of to say to her. Damn it. He smiled, praying it wasn't the fool's grin it felt like.
So what am I supposed to do all night while she makes out down there?
Some friend, she huffed.
Some beach party.
Where's the beach party? He asked, looking over the various couples, some playing catch, some just talking, some huddled nose to nose, their fingers sifting sand.
All around you, stupid, she laughed. See, that's Sandy and Fitzy, and that's Billy.
Hey, I'm sorry, she said, realizing that he didn't know any of them.
They're all from school. My roommate was supposed to bring a date for me, but her date and mine never showed up. So off she goes with the first thing in...
Your date?
His chest ached.
The guy you're engaged to? The guy from college?
Lavaliered. We're lavaliered. No, not him. He's working. He couldn't come up all this way just for a night.
She stubbed out her cigarette, screwing it into the sand.
Oh,
Norm said with the faintest hope. She turned over on her stomach, facing him on the blanket. Her white bathing suit glowed in the night. Perspiration glistened between her breasts. She hunched up on her elbows and sighed, looking down at the water. He lifted his head, straining to see more. Nipple. He wanted to see nipple. She flipped over on her side, one arm under her head. He lay on his side now and refocused.
Well, she sighed, this is a lost cause. If I had a ride, I'd leave now.
There. There it was, one fat, brown-nippled breast slung heavily over the other.
Oh, God! Are you here alone?
She asked. What's that?
Are you here alone?
In a way, he said quickly.
Not with my brother, I hope.
She grimaced.
No.
With a date?
Not tonight, he said lamely.
Would you mind terribly giving me a ride home, Norman? I have a brutal headache.
She pressed her fingertips against both temples.
Sure,
he shrugged, trying to appear calm. What would he do with Benji? He could leave him here and come back for him later. Now his mother would kill him. Benji could ride